Two. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lynn, and I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hello.
Happy Father's Day tomorrow, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Hi, happy Father's Day to everyone. Yeah. Well, tomorrow. Yes, absolutely. I hope all you fathers out there have a wonderful day tomorrow. And we are missing Dave today, but maybe he'll stop in later. He got tied up with something else. But anyway, our episode today is titled The Odyssey of Flight 33, starring John Anderson. And I'll turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
You'll find each of your names on the passenger manifest of this jet aircraft that travels from London to New York City. You'll sit in these seats and you'll go through an experience unique beyond words and tense beyond anything I believe you've ever seen.
You'll be departing at about this time.
In a vehicle we call the Odyssey of Flight 33. But be prepared for a stop midway in the Twilight Zone.
Come fly with, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Lama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's float down in the blue.
Wish I could do that. I can't click my fingers, but...
Thank you, Robert. That was absolutely perfect for this episode. Okay, folks, the Odyssey of Flight 33 is about Flight Global 33. A passenger jetliner that picks up a freak tailwind that causes it to travel at supersonic speed. They see a flash of light, hear a deafening roar, and suddenly they can't establish any radio contact at all. So in an effort to make some visual contact, they descend to a lower elevation and discover that they've traveled back in time, and they're smack dab in the middle of the prehistoric age, dinosaurs and everything. So Captain Farber, who's in command of the jetliner, realizes that their only chance to get back to their own time is to try to recapture that freak tailwind again. So they succeed, and when they descend again, they're relieved to see the familiar New York City skyline. However, when they contact the LaGuardia Airport Tower, the voice on the radio has never heard of radar or jetliners or them. Suddenly, they look out the window and see some very unwelcome sights, the Perisphere and Trilon, of the 1939 New York World's Fair. They went back, but not far enough. Captain Farber decides to reveal the situation to the panic-stricken passengers and tells them to pray. Running low on fuel, they know they have to try again in one final attempt to get back home. Maybe the third time's a charm. Well, Odyssey of Flight 33 has always been one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes, and what makes it so good is the believability of the actors playing the flight crew and the overall suspense of this episode. I mean, the very idea of the plane going back in time to the prehistoric era left me shaking my head and wondering how they were going to resolve the situation when they tried to reverse the process, only to end up in 1939 instead of 1961. I kept thinking they should have landed at LaGuardia to at least refuel. Now, I know Bobby...
Thank you.
Yes,
that's
exactly
what I said, too, yeah.
Right, exactly. Now, I know Bobby had mentioned in his original review that it's obvious the food and the fuel aren't going to last very long. So it may have been worth the enormous hassle of dealing with the CAA just to get the necessary juice into the plane. And I agree with that. And then you do too, Robert. I mean, it was just, mm-hmm. Insane that they decided to keep going with this thing, knowing that they were going to run out of juice. You know, and also what I found very interesting is, in the book, the Twilight Zone Companion, there's a recounting or a recollection by Rod Serling's brother, Robert Serling, about just how he became involved with this episode. And Robert Serling, he was an aviation writer for United Press International, and Rod wanted his input on just what cockpit dialogue would occur in a situation like this. And what I found really interesting was that Robert said that Rod received many letters from pilots saying that this episode was the most technically accurate piece than anybody had ever done on an airplane flight. And I thought that was quite a compliment and very well deserved in this case. And also, you know, there wasn't much focus on the passengers, but you really didn't need, and nor did you have the time to deal with the passenger reactions. But there's one brief scene in which one of the passengers tells another that he felt an acceleration of speed, which was enough to make us realize that it wasn't just the crew experiencing this, but it was how the crew handled the crisis that was the most compelling part of the episode. That's what was really the focus and what should have been the focus. But my favorite scene occurred when they showed the dinosaurs. Whoever put together that stock footage of the dinosaurs picked a great shot. I absolutely love how the dinosaur seems to look directly up at the plane a couple of times. I mean, this damn dino looked as confused as the crew was, and I love that footage. You just see the plane going by and the dinosaur looking up going, what the heck? You know, and the crew's looking down like, what the heck?
I mean, and it would have been nice to have a little caiman there, too, kind of going back and forth.
Oh, that would have been perfect, wouldn't it? That would have been absolutely perfect. I love that scene. That stock footage was perfect for that. And, you know, I thought all the actors did a fantastic job. You know, you have Sandy Kenyon. He was, one of the great character actors. I mean, all of the actors, I thought, were fabulous in this. But John Anderson, he has to be commended for his stellar performance as Captain Farber. Now, Anderson is or should be a familiar face to Twilight Zone fans because he's appeared in 4 episodes now. He played the Angel Gabriel in Passage for Trumpet, and he appeared in, of late, I think, of Clifferville and The Old Man in the Cave. So he's been in 4, you know, he's like Barney Phillips. Barney Phillips was in 4 episodes. You know, Rod loved to use the same actors over and over. And there are a lot of the character actors like Cyril Delavante, who was the old bank clerk in Penny for Your Thoughts. You know, he loved to use the same actors over, and Cyril was in like 3 or 4 episodes. So, you know, I think it's nice that Rod just had his particular character actors that he liked to use over and over.
Well, Wheaton's like that too. He, you know, the one that created Buffy and Angel and Firefly, he usually used a lot of people from his other shows and different shows too.
Yeah, they just like use the same, the same character actors over and over because they have a friendship developed with them, or they just, you know, Rod just respects their work, or you know, it's just great to see these people used over and over again. And,
Burgess. I love Burgess. I think he's great.
Oh, Burgess, yeah. Even with his main stars. I mean, look at Burgess. He's been in the most. What's 5 episodes? Him, Shatner. You know, he just loves to use the same guys, and I think that's wonderful. You know, because most of these guys are worth using over and over again. And of course, in your review, Robert, you said that this episode reminds you of The Final Countdown, among a few other things. Mm-hmm. And Final Countdown is without a doubt one of my favorite movies, time travel movies. You know, Kirk Douglas, James Farentino, Catherine Ross, excellent, excellent movie.
Just Martin Sheen, yep.
Martin Sheen, of course, yeah. And just the difference between, you know, what kind of ship was that? Aircraft.
Nimitz. Yeah,
right, aircraft carrier. Yeah, and in this case, it's a jetliner. But anyway, this episode makes for great viewing and gets an excellent rating of 4 from me. So I just loved it. So not quite classic, but very close. So I'm going to turn that over to you, Robert.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. And before I start, I got to play this clip here.
Whoa, this is heavy. There's that word again, heavy. Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
I love that line from the first Back to the Future.
I recognize that right away. For Lloyd.
Well, anyway, I kind of gave this one a good. I did enjoy this episode. Things that I did enjoy was John Anderson as Captain Flavor. He did a great job. There were some other shows that he appeared in, The Big Valley for season 1. I remember that. Psycho.
Psycho.
car dealer, used car dealer, and that one MacGyver. I think he played MacGyver's father in that series. So yeah, he's
I forgot about that. I was wondering when you mentioned MacGyver, I was trying to think what he played in that. You're right. Mhm.
Yeah, he played MacGyver's father. So
just so calm and cool in this episode is what I like. The calmness, and because you have to be that way in that kind of situation.
I did too, and. You know, the whole thing that kind of got to me was they also should have shaked the plane just a little bit more instead of, you know, to show that there was some turbulence in the plane instead of, you know, just shaking it when they get ready to cross the sound barrier or what I call it the time portal to go from one place, you know, go from here to there type situation.
It was pretty steady there.
You know, for a plane to be in a jet stream going at the sound of light, and it's just the believability of this. You know, how can you believe a plane built that way if they're going that fast structurally? How could that plane stay sound also? Because you got to remember, an airline craft isn't built. If you compare an airline craft to a spaceship, you know, a spaceship is going to be more built better, able to withstand, you know, going in and out of the atmosphere. Whereas a plane, if you had high, fast speed, you think it would rip that plane up. So the thing of believability for this episode that you kind of have to, you know, set that aside and say, well, they're going through that jet stream thing. And, yeah, I mentioned, I think that was a claymation dinosaur. It kind of funny to me when I was watching that like you, Lynn. I thought that was pretty cool, too. And like I said, when we were talking, you had a little caiman in there, you know, something like that, throwing arrows.
That would have been great. Kind of nice.
Yeah.
That would have added something special. I like it. Or maybe one of those flying, what did you call them, the raptors that would have flown.
Oh, yeah, the raptors flying around. I think it was called a brontosaurus, and I can't remember if it's a vegetable dinosaur that liked eat, or, you know, vegetation, or if it was a carnivore. I'm not sure.
I think the brontosaurus was the herbivore, would eat the
herbivore,
trees.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And I think the T-Rex was the carnivore.
Right. Here again, you know, the cabin looked great. I mean, a lot better than Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I know a lot of us, sci-fi fans have watched Ed Wood Jr.'s Plan 9 from Outer Space, where the cockpit consists of a chair with a wooden stand and a wooden wheel as a controller to act like an airplane cockpit. So, and then a clipboard on the back. But
yeah,
you know what kind of threw it off though is they had pegboard in this cockpit. It probably was the bubble wrap at that time. You know, go ahead and whatever we build or sets, what we'll use on pegboard, but
exactly.
Still, you know, the instruments made it nice. You know what they should have done? Took the camera and focused on some of the instruments, showing the dials going around and around, showing how fast that even they couldn't keep up with.
They didn't show any dials or anything, did they?
No, they didn't show no instrumentation, which I thought would have been kind of cool.
Yeah.
And the other thing I brought up, which we talked about too, was, you know, what I said in my review, is why didn't Global Flight 33 go ahead and land at LaGuardia Airport, like you said? I said at least they could have refueled the plane, got supplies, and took off and tried again. In 1939, it did have airplanes. If they didn't have the correct fuel, they could have adapted the engines to use the fuel of that time.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then took them back on. I mean, you know, like changing lead to unleaded. There's things that you can add to your engines to change from an engine that uses lead gasoline to one that uses unleaded. And because they only had enough for one more shot at getting home. And,
yeah, I don't know if I would have wanted to take that chance, because if they run out of fuel, that plane's going to just pull out of the sky.
Well, they're going to have to land where would they end up landing. I mean, which way the airplane was going, I guess they were going direction towards the future. You know, they could have landed, you know, in the year 2250, where there's no such thing as jet fuel at all, and then they're stuck right there in the future.
Exactly. And plus, going at supersonic speed, I would think that more fuel would be used.
Yeah.
So
because you're constantly using more fuel.
Right. So it's either juice it up now, or, you know, if you don't juice it up now, you're risking having to land wherever, or your plane falling out of the sky. One or the other. You're endangering the passengers is the way I looked at it.
Right. So that's what I mean. It was very foolish that they didn't do that and took care of that while they were there.
The guy said they could land.
What would have threw them off, too? I mean, you know, what's the shock of a jet plane that nobody's ever seen or heard of, which would be pretty alien in 1939?
Well, that's why they were afraid to land. Mm-hmm.
Probably, yeah. But still, take the risk.
I would have. You know, I mean, he was afraid we can't land. He says, we can't land here. Why not? Okay, it's going to be like a frenzy. People are going to say, what the hell is this? You know, what is this plane? You know, this gigantic plane. And, you know, they would have been questioned. They would have had to go up to the CAA. But I still wouldn't. I would have done that rather than risk the life of all the passengers.
Well, also, we're into almost the start of World War II. World War II for us starts in 41 with the attack on Pearl Harbor. And so you got B-52s and stuff that used, you know, the kind of fuel that they need, you know, to run those big fortress in the skies, as they called them during the war.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Why didn't they land and warn everybody about Pearl Harbor? They could have saved a lot of lives.
Yeah, like the Final Countdown.
Final Countdown.
Knew what happened with the Final Countdown. When they get ready to get started, then that phenomenon reappears, and then the ship, they go back and do the phenomenon again. So here's that situation, Bobby, that they say, can't change time, that time is constant, and time travel shows, and even you have said that, where, you know, you get to that point to where you think you can change anything, then you find out you can't, and then,
look,
you know,
the
what's the use of even trying?
Occurred.
Like back there with the Lincoln.
Yeah, because the event has already occurred, so there's no changing it now. You can try, but it's not going to make any difference. And it's crazy, and, you know, you would think you go back in time, you change it, and then the whole future changes. But it can't because it's already occurred. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, in a sense, it turns into the Flying Dutchman, as I said. You know, it goes on forever, never making it back home, and it's being stuck in time forever. So,
right.
But three things I brought up. One thing I did, when the Back to the Future, the second film, the ending was one of my favorite, where the lightning hits the DeLorean, very much like the airplane going through the time portal. And then I didn't put the ending part on this one, but the ending part of the Western Union was part of my favorite, like right at the end, the Doc gets taken back in time. But here's that real quick scene.
Doc, come in, Doc. Doc, do you read me? Do you read me, Doc? Come in. Doc! Oh, no. He's gone.
And then the scene picks up where the Western Union guy comes and says, "Are you Marty McFly?"
Yeah.
We had this letter for 80 years or something like that. Joe Flaherty as the Western Union guy. That was great. Yeah.
It was, yeah.
But, you know, the way the DeLorean disappeared, what it reminded me of. So.
Great movie. Good movie.
Yep. Another one I mentioned in my review was the trailer Millennium. And that was a 1989 movie where a plane crash and all the passengers disappear. It had Chris Christopherson and Cheryl Ladd in that movie. Go ahead and play that.
DOA 35 Heavy, could you give me your location?
Minneapolis, we are currently heading 0.
DOA 35, turn to heading.
My God.
Jesus, down.
Go down.
For Flight 35.
We are going down.
It was the end.
Do not be afraid.
Was it?
Walk towards the light.
What unusual facts have you developed in your investigation?
This crash has been crazy from the start.
Is there anything odd?
Going backwards. I'm afraid I still don't know what you're driving at.
I'm simply looking for the inexplicable. I usually find it.
Endangering a project that's bigger than you can imagine.
They know damn well we can't change the past.
Time travels. You don't want to be found. Then you are from the future.
About 1,000 years.
Sherman, send the gate.
Once in 1,000 years comes an adventure like this.
We've been expecting you.
Millennium.
And the whole thing with that is Chris Thompson plays an NTSB official, and Cheryl Ladd plays a time traveler from the future called Louise Baltimore. And the whole thing is they're trying to steal people already destined to die in airplane crashes in order to restock humankind in their own desolate future. So
I haven't seen that movie in years.
No, I watched
it. They don't
it,
they don't show it very often in reruns. I mean,
well, it didn't do that well in the box office. It was 1989 when it aired.
Oh yeah, it did terrible at the box office. They hardly ever show it, you know, on television. But I haven't seen it in a long time.
And then my final clip is the final countdown.
December the 6th, 1980, the nuclear-powered attack aircraft carrier USS Nimitz, with a crew of 5,000 men and a strike force of 90 aircraft, was on a routine mission in the Pacific when it encountered a storm unlike any ever recorded and disappeared.
Check out, but we're off the air.
Any word from our destroyers?
We aren't getting anything except some code transmissions in the 200 meter band. Otherwise, we're dead as a doornail.
Ops, what's our radar picture?
Radar shows us clear, sir.
Can't you see that Russian trawler?
I have the signal officer on deck, but no visual sighting, sir.
All of us know that movement through time is possible. Einstein proved it. There are forces in the universe which we're only now just beginning to understand. I mean understand through science, not superstition. There are black holes in space, antimatter, curved space. Things that are as strange to us as electricity would have been to people in the Middle Ages. Or this ship in World War II.
What's happening here? Who are you people?
Are we at war? Is that what happened?
Splash the zeros. I say again, splash the zeros.
We've got an incredible opportunity here. We know where all the mistakes are going to be made in the next 40 years, and you've got the power to correct them.
I've got planes out there.
Those planes give us all a second chance. We're a bunch of damn fools if we don't take it.
Those men have enough knowledge among them to build the atom bomb. Reach the moon years before it should have happened.
Is that a terrifying prospect, Captain? Or a tempting one?
On December the 6th, 1980, the nuclear carrier USS Nimitz disappeared in the Pacific and reappeared December 6th, 1941, off the coast of Pearl Harbor. The final countdown is about to begin.
And of course, Martin Sheen was our info dump in that entire movie, so.
Yeah.
I guess he'd be the smart one to do it. So. Wonderful movie, great music.
Yes, it was.
The final countdown, yeah, I recommend it to anybody.
It is.
So.
Absolutely.
3 out of 5 is my rating, and I'll pass it over to Bobby.
All right.
Thank you, Robert. This episode actually makes history. Not Twilight Zone history, and not Rod and Serling history, but history for me. Because since I started our group and started putting up polls, I'm always the first person to vote, simply because I create the polls and I put them there. And this is going to mark the first time ever that I've changed my number, my vote, in a poll. And it's not going up, but going down. I gave the episode a 4, and I think I kind of got caught up in the hysteria of everybody saying that this is a great episode. And it's terribly memorable and things like that. But on further reflection and having seen it again yesterday, there are some flaws in it that I think really hurt. So I'm going to change that number later. And by the way, you can change numbers and polls at any time. And I'm going to take it down to 3. It certainly is a good episode. It certainly belongs in the upper tier of episodes, but I think they make a fatal mistake in it that really hurts the episode in general. I will say this before I start complaining about it like I usually do. I would say that I do admire one thing about it, and that is the fact that it's a different take on time travel stories. Most time travel stories, the writer can't wait to get the people involved to wherever they're going, whether it's backwards in time or forwards in time. And then we get the usual thing, trying to get out of there, trying to change history, trying this, trying that. In this case, you've got people who don't want to go forward or backward in time. They have no intention of going there. So the story doesn't focus on what the consequences are of going to either place, but the fact that they still intend to go there will do everything they can do to not have that happen. That, I think, is different, and I like that aspect of it. Because we've seen a lot of time travel stories in Twilight Zone. We've probably got more coming up that I can't think of at the moment. And there are plenty of movies involved, as Robert's already shown. So in this case, this is a little different. The episode is extremely claustrophobic, and that's what it has going for it, that it's very claustrophobic. In other airplane disaster movies, TV shows, whatever you want to call them, the focus is always on the passengers. What are they going to do? How are they going to live? Are they going to panic? Are they going to jump out the windows when they find out whatever is going to happen is going to happen? A very successful movie like Airport, which mainly involved the airport and get trying to plane down before a mad bomber could blow it up. But in this case, it's very claustrophobic because we see it from the cockpit. Not only from the cockpit, but not from behind, where it's like we're standing right by the instrument panel and we're just 2 inches right out of the plane. And so that's very claustrophobic because just like they have no way out, and they can't get off the plane, and they can't land, and they can't do anything, neither can we. And I think that's very important, and that adds a lot to this episode or any episode like that. And that's fine. I had no problem with that, and for as long as that was going on, I was cool with it. That was great. But then I think Sterling made a big mistake, and that's the fact that he allows the camera to go out of the cockpit into where the passengers are, which is a big mistake. Early in the episode, one of the sources come back says that they're starting to panic now. I don't need to see it. I can imagine what it's like. Let me use my imagination. For one thing, it's not about that. The story is not about the passengers. It's about the flight crew. That's what it's about. It's when you get right down to it. And so going out there kind of breaks the mood. I had no desire to leave the cockpit. I wanted to stay right where it was. So by the time you get to the end of it, you're ready to scream. You got to get out of there. So they go back there, all right, it's not a fatal mistake, we can live with it. But honestly, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my entire life. The stewardess tells twice in the episode, the first time she comes out, that people are getting nervous out there, something's not right. And then when she comes back later in the story, tells them that she's got a full-scale panic on her hand, that there's even a couple of kids back there, who've got, I think the exact words were, they're climbing the wall. Passengers climbing the wall. And that's all well and good. That probably might well be the case. But when the camera goes back there, everybody's just sitting as calmly as can be. Nobody seems excited about anything. Nobody seems nervous about anything. Lynn, in her opening comments, said that they were panic-stricken. That's news to me. I can't find anybody in there who looks at least a bit worried. For people who have just seen dinosaurs and the World Fair, they ought to at least have some emotion. They don't have any. And that just looks ridiculous. And it breaks the mood. Because if they're not worried, why should I be? I'm not worried either. They'll find a way out. And when I watch stories, I try to really get into it. I try to really be one of the characters to understand what they're going through. But it's absurd to have them all see there. I don't know why they hired all those extras to sit in this mock-up of the airplane if they were just going to sit there. It just looks absolutely ridiculous. It never should have been done. Or if you're going to do it, there's no time in a 25-minute story to show panic. They don't have time for it. So stay away from it. Just stay where you are and don't go back there and play that game unless you're willing to do something about it. And they didn't. And I think it's laughable. It's bad enough the first time. It's even worse later on because she goes into the cockpit and says, you got somebody going to get on the horn because I don't know what's going to happen out there. Okay. So when I go out there, I expect to see a full-scale panic. I see nothing. I didn't notice that much. It didn't bother me that much maybe the first few times I saw it. But when I watched it yesterday, it bothered me. And I thought to myself, this doesn't make any sense.
They must have been really polite back in the 1960s, Bobby, on airplanes, huh?
If they see dinosaurs below, I don't think so. If I see dinosaurs below, I'm not going to be blowing that into it. And even earlier than that, when the first stewardess comes back and sits off to the other stewardess, and she says to her, "We're in trouble." I mean, I would go, "We're in trouble. What's that mean?" And she never tells her what it is at all. And she just walks away and she says to her, "You better go be calm with passengers. We don't want to panic." And apparently she did a great job because nobody does panic. But I thought it was kind of amusing that she didn't ask the other stewardess what the problem is. I would have asked. I would have said, "What do you mean we're in trouble? Is the plane on fire? Are we going to crash? What's happening?" I would have wanted to know. But she just goes, "Oh my," and that's it. I hate episodes that where things aren't fully realized. Don't start it if you're not going to finish it, is my commentary on that. I really don't like that part of it. It's not a bad episode, don't get me wrong. I would never give it a bad rating, but I'm with Robert on this. I think 3 is more logical than 4. 4 is really pushing it. I went to IMDb about this, like I always do with the episodes, see what other people think who aren't members of this group or the show. And it gets a 7.9 out of 10, which is amazing. Because very few things at IMDb get up in the stratosphere of 7.5, 8.5. Just doesn't happen. So everybody liked it, everybody commented on it, says, "Oh, it's great, it's wonderful," and all of that. But I didn't need a full-scale panic in that in the plane. Just a little concern, somebody being nervous or something. Or if you're not going to do that, don't have the stewardess come out and say that there's a panic out there and then get out there and show absolutely nothing at all. The episode itself is not that exciting. It's not a whole lot really happens. Because, like I said, it is all atmosphere. It's not really an action-packed story. And that's fine. But, you know, keep it going. You only got about 25, 26 minutes to cover, so that should be easy to do.
They actually could have left just that one scene where the one passenger says, you know, "I felt an acceleration in speed," and
yeah, right.
You know, then you know that the passengers are experiencing too. That would have been plenty. That would have been enough. They didn't need to do anything more.
Oh, I don't need a full scale panic. I think it would have been ridiculous because there's no time for it. There's no time to go back there and see people at each other's throats or anything like that. That just doesn't make any sense. And even in even in many movies that have been made about airplane disasters, rarely does the do the passengers go crazy because the pilot is always reassuring and says, "Don't worry, everything's going to be fine." And if you're going to go up in the air, you put your faith in them and you're stuck with it, like it or not. But it is an unusual episode because we see it in the cockpit. And all the other airline or potential airline disaster stories I saw, and the first one I ever saw was when I was a little kid with The High and the Mighty. And I really loved that when I was a kid. I thought it was a great movie. And
John Wayne was great in that.
Yeah, it was an excellent film.
He was.
And it's kind of like the granddaddy of all airline disaster movies.
Love at the end, Bobby, where he looks at the engine and kind of blows the whistle.
Right.
Like, man, that was close.
Yeah, it was close. Right. It was close. As for the dinosaurs, well, here we go again. It did bother me. I agree. It's kind of cute to have the dinosaur look up at the plane.
Leave the dinosaurs alone. That was a
awesome. No, I can't leave it alone. Here's why.
It was awesome.
here's the problem with it. We have the little wind-up spaceman in the Invaders, and I defended that. Some people didn't like it and said, "Oh, it's stupid. It looks like little wind-up toys." And I defended it, and I think rightfully so, because this is a different direction. In that story, Agnes Moorehead's character was supposed to be gigantic, unbelievably huge. So it made sense to see these little tiny spacemen that look like toys. In this case, the dinosaurs have to be really, really big, even from the air. And they don't look all that big. They look kind of silly. It's very nostalgic for me, because they look just like the toy dinosaurs I had when I was about 7 years old. They look like that, too, and you could bend your heads upward and things like that. It was very enjoyable to have that. But in this, it doesn't wreck the episode, because, again, it's not about special effects. I want to take the task, not the story, but CBS. Because I think it's an absolute disgrace that CBS kept pulling on the financial strings of Rod Serling. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. They had a top-notch series. I don't remember whether it was ever number one. It sure was damn close if it wasn't. They had a great series going. They were very lucky to have that. They bought the right concept, and they had the right writer. Why bother? I keep reading this at other websites and places. They were giving him a hard time. They wanted him to cut back. It's costing too much. Costing too much money for what? I mean, they don't have any special effects. It's costing too much money for what? I don't know what they're talking about. And today, certainly TV's not like that today. If you have a successful show, you can spend all the money you want as long as you get the ratings and you're at the top. They'll give you anything you want. Back then, I think it was ridiculous. And remember that cutting back on expenses is what led to that awful hour-long where they wanted, I think there's something like 18 episodes or something, and they wanted to cut back expenses so they made it an hour and cut the season in half.
It's also the reason that we had to deal with the videotape.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that. And so what a disgrace for a major network like CBS to do that kind of thing. I'm sure Sterling must have gone crazy. And I don't blame them for having little toy dinosaurs or whatever those are down there. I would have thrown up my hands and said, all right, you're not going to give us any money to do anything? Fine. Then boom, this is what you get out of it.
That's why Sterling had a chance when he went to Night Gallery for 2 years to be able to have a little more freedom with that series,
Right.
Exactly.
So, if I was the head of CBS, I should be so lucky, I would say, no, let's cut back somewhere else. I wouldn't touch that series. I would say, we're lucky he's still doing it. He could have decided that I'm out of here. I'm quitting the way Jack Gleason decided not to do the Honeymooners anymore. And so they were lucky to have him there as long as they did. But give the man some money. Give him free reign to do what he has to do, and don't do that. So now every time I see this kind of thing, I think to myself, it was the same way with this episode we just did, 22. Same story there. And as a matter of fact, we remember what we said. We kind of agreed that rather than showing that airplane blowing up, that looked like two stagehands lighting a fire from some firecrackers, which is probably what it was, they should have just shown an explosion in the window of the terminal when she went back in there. And we would have gotten the message, oh, my God, the plane blew up. But by doing it the other way, if you don't have the money and you don't have the expertise and there isn't the kind of special effects there is today, then give me a break. Do it some other way. There are other ways to do it. So I'm going to lower my vote because I think 4 is really kind of a stretch. Robert, is it any time where you were thinking about 4 and I think it's a little odd?
No, I pretty much voted before I did the review when that poll first came out, and I gave it a 3, and I pretty much stick with that. 4, it's not really a 4 to me, so.
Yeah, because there's something lacking there. And it all depends, like I said when we did 22, it depends on what we're talking about here. For instance, in Time Enough at Last, it really looks realistic that Burgess Meredith is standing there with all those books all over the place. And I didn't have a problem with that at all, even though there's a painted backdrops in the bag. That really looks more realistic than a lot of things that I've seen later in the series. I don't know how much it costs to have all those books around all over the down days, but it certainly is more realistic than some of the things I've seen since. But it's a decent episode. I agree the actors, as I said in my review, a cast of a very well-known character actors on the place. And it's so claustrophobic. That whole thing looks so, they seem to be sitting on top of each other. And then when the stewardess comes in, it gets even worse. So I felt a lot of claustrophobia. It's possible to feel very uneasy because you can't go anywhere. I agree with all the other things that were said. It was ridiculous to decide you can't land in the airport, so we'll keep flying knowing that you're going to die. That doesn't seem smart to me. If I was one of the passengers and they asked what we want to do, I would say, I'll tell you what, rather than crash, let's land anywhere. Not with the dinosaurs, obviously, but...
Right.
I thought they were very lucky. They were lucky to get to... That was only 20 years ago. That was
1939.
Right.
Well, if they wanted to, they could have kept a secret and pulled the plane into a hangar once the plane landed, supplied it. If it's not the right fuel for the plane, find some way, get the engineers out to try to adapt the fuel for that plane, and then once they get back, if they ever do make it back, then they can revert it back to the jet fuel that they use.
What was that episode we all didn't like? The one where the pilot landed?
The last flight?
Oh, yeah, the last flight.
Oh, God, yes.
Well, I didn't like it either. Yeah, I know. So I would have voted to land back. Besides, I would have liked to have seen the World's Fair anyway. So while we were there, I would have seen the fair. And as long as you're going to die afterwards anyway, you might as well get something done. But it's okay. It's just another time travel story. Like I said, it's unusual. Of all other time travel stories, the people who write them can't wait to get the person there. You know what my favorite time travel story really is? That's the movie, The Time Machine with Rod Taylor. I'm sure you know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. That I think is it, and they do some fancy special effects in there. Considering, I think it was made in the late 50s or 1960. I think was the year, and that was really my favorite time travel story. But if I remember correctly, he only goes ahead; he doesn't go back in time at all. It's pretty good. I'll give it a 4 and leave it at that.
No, you're giving it a 3.
A 3. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you backed it down.
Yeah, 3.
Yeah, well, you see, I have to stick with my 4 because of two reasons. The acting was fabulous. It was very, very realistic because Rod brought in his brother who knew exactly what type of dialogue should be.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Uh-huh.
I agree. Robert Sterling added a lot to the episode. But isn't it kind of odd that the airplane shook only when they went through the time barrier? Shouldn't it be shaking at least a little the rest
That's
of the time?
That's what Robert said.
That's what
I
said.
What
yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, there should be a little bit.
People at IMDb would have said that, but it doesn't make any sense. How come it's... One person said it looked like a mock-up of an airplane on soundstage.
There should have been a little bit more turbulence. But, you know, I thought the acting was superb. I thought it was very realistic. And because of Robert Sterling, that's why it was so realistic, because he knew exactly what dialogue should have taken place in that situation. And as you said, the claustrophobic feeling, they looked like they were so sandwiched together in there. You know, they were so together in that, you know, so tight in that cockpit that you just couldn't wait for them to be able to get out of that situation. And I thought that was just superb. That's why I give it a 4. I give it a 4 only because of that.
I think they should have found the survivor from a real airline crash, and there have been survivors, to advise them on what the passengers would have been done facing imminent death in the plane crash. Because I'm sure they could give you a word or two about what that field was.
That's probably true. That's probably true.
Bobby?
Yeah.
While you were talking, you were wondering when the next time travel episode was. I'm looking at season 3. The next plane one is The Arrival. That's number 67, which looks like the precursor of Millennium.
Absolutely.
And the time travel one is Once Upon a Time. That's the, I think, the one with Buster Keaton.
Buster Keaton?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that another one of those lame attempts at comedy?
Mm-hmm.
I hate comedy this year.
Why?
Time traveling helmet.
Yes. That episode is one I can really do without, but, you know, we'll get to that. Oh, and guess who's here?
Hi, Dave. Dave's here.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, everyone. Sorry, I got lost. I went to the World's Fair by mistake.
I hope he had a nice time at the World's Fair. At least you weren't with the dinosaurs.
Robert, did you mention Time Flight?
The ones that I mentioned was The Final Countdown, Back to the Future, and Millennium.
Okay.
Was the ones I mentioned. So
it is your
turn. You
have
to mention Time Flight in yours. Yeah.
We would have just been getting up to you now, so it's your turn.
Okay. Well, I'm talking blind, everybody, but that's not a bad thing in one sense, because the whole thing about people that come on Talking Twilight Zone is that you can't always agree on whether an episode is total rubbish or has some delights. I quite enjoyed this one. I must admit that I do have a soft spot for the chap who played the captain, marvelous actor.
John Anderson. He's been in four episodes,
Well, I loved him in the trumpet for Gabriel, was it?
Passage for Trumpet,
I loved him in that. And I've seen him in, obviously he was in the was it Star Trek The Next Generation one?
He was in that one.
Yeah, so
he was also in MacGyver, The Big Valley, Psycho. He played the used car man in Psycho. So yeah, he's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, he's a very tall man, about 6'5" So he got a lot of parts, and he looks a bit like Abe Lincoln. So I suppose he got some parts from that.
Excellent
actor. Yeah, I liked it well. I could even forgive the rather plastic model dinosaur that they fly over, because
I thought it was claymation.
I love those dinosaurs. I love those dinosaurs. I love how the dinosaur looks up at the plane. I mean, it's just great.
I said they need like little cave people there throwing arrows at it.
Yeah,
to make it complete.
Yeah, I mean the only sort of odd logic thing that you think of as a science fiction person is that their way of getting out of it was to climb back into the jet stream. But I was thinking that if they climb back into the jet stream and try to do it again, basically they go further into the past. You'd think they'd have to try and fly against the jet stream, whether that would be possible or not. But I love the idea of it, and I love the way they were so conservative within the cockpit. You know, the poor passengers. You know, keep them in the dark as long as you possibly can. You know, send the trolley around, give them free drinks, anything to stop them from panicking. Very self-contained. It's similar. I always relate these things to Doctor Who. When they do Doctor Who for money issues, what they do now and again is an episode they call the bottle episode, which is basically a very self-contained, single studio setup, as it were. And of course, this virtually all takes place on the flight deck. But having said that, I thought it really worked extremely well. All right, it's no great classic, but the whole point about the Twilight Zone is that some of the ones that, for me, are great ones, they almost don't need 22 minutes to tell the story, because they're basically, it's a novel idea that you could tell the story in 10 minutes, really, if you were brutal about it. And in fact, I think the best thing that could ever have happened to Twilight Zone was if they'd allowed them to have variable time slots. In other words, you know, this story needs 15 minutes to tell. We'll tell it in 15 minutes. You'll have a great story. This story needs 35 minutes to tell. We'll have 35 minutes. It's a great story. But one of the hardest things about Twilight Zone is, however simple the concept of the story, however complex, they have to either stretch it out or concertina it to fit this 22 and a half minutes or whatever it is the running time. But I would give it a middle of the road 3 out of 5, I suppose. And as an episode, I always liked time travel, so I liked it.
Great.
See, Bobby, that's why the pastures were calm. They were all drunk.
That's right. And they should be if they're in a situation like, can you imagine being on a plane, looking out the window and seeing a dinosaur looking up at you? Now, if you've had, a few margaritas, you're looking down and you're saying, well, that was pretty cool. You know,
yeah.
We must be
able to flying over Disneyland.
Yeah, one thing I must say with the episode 22, I wonder if the airline companies were running adverts over this show, because it crashes one week, the other one gets lost in time.
That puts a little scare into you, doesn't it?
The only because thing of course it doesn't been... end. It doesn't end. You don't know if they get back, which was
That's
a
right.
nice little. So it didn't have a happy ending. Didn't have an ending at all.
Yeah, and if you remember, Rod Serling's closing narration was, if you should hear a plane up above you that seems lost in the distance, you know, send up a flare or something, because it's Global 33 trying to find its way home. You know, it's a little scary there, you know?
Yeah, and we did have a similar story, didn't we? We had the one, the crashed plane in the desert and the pilot.
Oh, yeah. King 9 will not return.
This
was a better way of doing a similar thing, because he's doing that. He's in a crash plane, and then he sees jets flying overhead, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yes, that's right, and he doesn't know what they are. But that was a terrible episode.
Two bites of the cherry.
Do you think the plane should have landed and refueled and then went back up into the clouds?
No, because they might have trained. If they'd have done that, it would have been a whole different story, because they might have gone back and changed history so that when they finally got back to their own time, they'd get there and something would be different. Let's say it showed you the captain being married at the beginning, and he'd land there and he wouldn't have a wife, or he'd have a different wife, or something like that. They would have to have shown that they would have influenced the time, because just them landing, it might well be that in the observatory was Barnes Wallace, or whoever it was who invented the jet engine, and he had a sneak preview of what a jet engine was from that, a little bit like the one with the Final Countdown, was it, Robert?
Mm-hmm.
Where
the ship
the ship goes into Pearl Harbor. And if they'd have taken part in that war, they would have changed history. And as it happens, the fog closes around them before they actually engage.
The control tower asks what kind of plane it is. And the pilot says a jet airliner. And the control tower says a what? Or what is a jet airliner? That doesn't inspire confidence. I'm not sure I would have landed. You know, I mean, they never heard of a jet airliner, and all of a sudden one's going to land.
I would think if brought into a hangar and just kept quiet, nobody leaves, just go ahead and supply the plane. Because you got to remember, like I said, I bet you they're very low on food, they're very low on fuel, and the only chance they have is one last chance, because you knew by the time they went back up there, they were almost out of fuel, so they only had one more option to try.
That's
would
right.
have taken the chance.
That's right, because flights rarely have more than enough food to cover one or two meals. It's like you have mm-hmm. your meal on the flight, you know, and nowadays you don't even get a meal. You know, most of
us don't. Well, for that, you don't get food to anybody, so you can fly around forever now.
Yeah, yeah, because nowadays you go on a flight, you get a drink, and that's it. You know,
you're not going to run out of food, but there isn't any. That's not a problem.
For the beverage car comes around, they might throw a pack of peanuts at you, and sometimes you don't even get that, so you don't even get food. But back then, you did get a meal, you know, back in the 60s. And up until the 80s and early 90s, you did get a meal on the plane. You know, you got, you know, some kind of a lunch or box lunch or something. But they would have enough for one meal. Maybe they have enough in emergency for two, but that's about it. You know, you've got a full plane, you know.
And one thing I should say, that it was actually Fran Whittle who was one of the inventors. But they were experimenting with them was it 1928? So they should have heard. Certainly people who are at an airport control should have heard of experimental jet engines by then.
Yeah,
in Germany they were doing rocket engines during the war on that one over in Germany,
yeah.
I remember they said that, you know, when the war ended, some of the German scientists were brought over to America,
Well, in January 1930 in England, Whittle submitted his first patent, granted in 1932. The patent showed a two-stage turbojet engine.
Well, Dave, let me ask you something. Do you think that if they had just stopped in LaGuardia to refuel, that really may have changed time in the future? I mean, just stopping to refuel?
Yes, as I say, if let's say you've got one of my best friends, Jack, is a real aircraft spotter. I mean, he goes over to the States. He goes over to these big places in is it Arizona or wherever, where you have these mothballed airplanes and things like that. And he's been to various places where the police have come along and wondered why they're taking photographs of planes and things. Well, the point is, if you're a young designer of aircraft, where you're going to spend your time? You're going to be in the flight lounge watching planes land and take off and studying them. And if you suddenly happened to be there on that day and saw this plane come in with this revolutionary design, streamlined, made of aluminium rather than whatever they were made of, and you think, cool. You do a drawing of it furiously on a napkin. And then before you know it, the Second World War starts with jet planes already well developed. So
well, it's kind of like Scotty in Star Trek IV, where he gives the scientist the transparent aluminum.
Yeah,
he
that's
says,
right.
Well, how do you know he didn't invent it? That's what Scotty said.
Well, I do stick by my 4 rating, as I said, because I think the story was great. I loved the acting. The acting was fabulous. The realistic aspect of what went on in the cockpit, mainly because of Rod's brother, Robert Serling, you know, just knowing exactly what dialogue and what would be said in such a situation. I just think it was a really wonderful episode. And as far as the dinosaurs, you can pick on them all you want, but I love that stock footage, and I love the dinosaur looking up at the plane, and that's another reason I'm giving it a 4. So that's my...
Hey, Davey, look out for that dinosaur.
But I absolutely agree with you there, Lynn. I think the way the cockpit crew acted, whether it's real or not, I don't know. I've not been in the cockpit, but it gave that realism to the story.
Well, that was the thing. Rod Serling asked his brother, Robert, who was an aviation writer for the United Press International, to tell him what dialogue would be going on in a cockpit in a situation such as that. And Robert Sterling told him exactly what they would be saying, and that's why it's so realistic. And I thought that was great. And I mentioned earlier when you weren't here that some people had written to Rod Sterling, and pilots, airline pilots that saw the episode had written to Rod Sterling and said this was one of the most authentic pieces one of the most authentic stories and pieces ever written on an airline flight, about an airline flight. And that was a very well-deserved compliment. So I think it's a pretty good episode, and I'm still sticking by my 4 rating. And, you know, threes and fours seem to be what it's getting. So that's pretty good.
Has consultants on their movies to give them the actual feel of what it's like.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you said it was better than an airplane, and stop calling me Shirley.
Shirley, you disagreed. Don't call me Shirley.
Or any movie with George Kennedy in it there.
Leslie Nielsen, George Kennedy. There you go. Oh, man. So what do we got going in 2 weeks? We have from now on July 2nd, Mr. Daniel Strong with Burgess Meredith and Don Rickles. And
I just watched that last night.
Yeah, there are very mixed feelings on that one. Some people love it, some people love it, some people like it, some people hate it. So, you know, that should be an interesting discussion. So that'll be 2 weeks from now on July 2nd, and hopefully everyone can be here for that. Anybody else have anything to add? Nope. All righty then. So we will see you in 2 weeks for Mr. Dingle the Strong. Have a great weekend, everybody, and have a happy Father's Day to all of you fathers out there. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll go out with a little prank here.
Say, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.